in using them, but I love them. I love teaching them, and I have a loose parameter of wishing to have a pantoum in every book.
Has that been happening so far?
I've done pretty well. Not exact, yeah. But I'm pretty good.
Thank you for being on Between the Covers today, Lauren.
It's been a very big pleasure. Thank you.
Talking today to the poet Lauren Camp about her latest book from Tupelo Press, Took House. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio.
Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser. Carol Lay has been creating comics, both alternative and mainstream, since the 1980s. She's a writer, illustrator, and animator whose weekly comic, Story Minute, ran in newspapers for 20 years. In 2007, Carol visited Portland for the Stumptown Comics Fest and took time out of her busy schedule to share her formidable storytelling skills with our radio listeners. And now, Carol Lay, interviewed by Bill Dodge at the KBOO Studios in September of 2007.
What are you, the fashion police?
My guest on this installment of Words and Pictures, Carol Lay, has been a professional cartoonist and illustrator for more than 25 years. She has done work for indie and mainstream comics, magazines, and newspapers, as well as animation and storyboards for live-action film projects. Carol's weekly strip, Story Minute, has been running over a decade on the web and in newspapers all over the world, including Salon.com, the LA Weekly, and the Wall Street Journal. Her strips and illustrations have also appeared in The New Yorker, Mad Magazine, and Newsweek.
This one's called Pants on Fire. Every day she would go up to some stranger and say, "I know what you did." Most people stare at her uncomprehendingly. More than one person bolted like a frightened deer, and she says, "I win." One man called her bluff. "Do you approve?" And she thinks, "Say yes." And she says, "Yes." And he says, "Then we should go out and discuss doing it together." She thinks, "Do what?" She couldn't refuse. He would win. All right. So they met for dinner, and he put forth his proposition. "Let's do it Saturday." And she thinks, "Do what?" But she says, "Okay." He says, "I'll pick you up at 8. Dress appropriately." She tried to figure out what that meant. He's so dashing and sophisticated. I'll bet he's into fox hunting. So she bought an outfit for fox hunting. When he showed up, he was dressed like a bum. "You go dumpster diving in that getup?" She bolted like a frightened deer, and he says, "I win."
You're in town for the 5th annual Stumptown Comics Fest here in Portland. How's that been so far for you, Carol?
I'm having a really fun time. I'm seeing people I haven't seen in years, and
yeah,
actually talking to people about comics instead of dodging people who are involved in the TV or film business, which is what's happened to San Diego. I like this smaller convention and seeing all these young, earnest, talented kids, you know, that are doing mini comics and, you know, working their way into the business.
I like to ask about influences, if you'd care to go into that, about what inspired you as a kid to want to draw.
I loved reading the newspaper comics. Al Capp was probably my biggest influence just because of his goofball ideas.
Yeah.
The Schmooze and Kickapoo Joy Juice and all that just really sang to me as far as the imagination went. I also liked Ricochet for the drawing and the characters. Mm-hmm. And not much else, actually. I liked Brenda Starr because it was weird.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out who Hank was for the longest time. And quite androgynous. And so I couldn't figure out with that name, was she male or female? And there was a similar character in the Nancy Drew books. So of maybe the creators were just speaking up for a very invisible part of our society at the time. I didn't really get into comics until I was in college and I read the Zap comics, which really blew a hole in my brain. It was between S. Clay Wilson and Crumb. Both of those people were, I was just, holy mackerel, what's going on here? But that still didn't inspire me to start drawing comics. It wasn't until after I left college, and I had majored in fine art at UCLA. I got my degree and was so disillusioned with art by that time that I almost became a computer nerd. But my mother got me to start drawing number and letter cards for her first grade class that she taught. And that got me into comics through a very elemental back door. I liked the pragmatism of cartooning and the lack of pretension, which has gotten back into comics by this time. But back then it was a very supportive community in the underground world. And
so you met a lot of these people that were making comics at that time. Did they inspire you to, or encourage you to continue?
Yeah, I met some people. I had been trying my hand at illustrating science fiction books. And through that, I started meeting people that were doing comics. And, you know, like Sergio Aragonés, Scott Shaw, Bill Stout, you know, people in Southern California. So I started getting lettering gigs, and then I just taught my way into writing and drawing comics. I swiped whoever I could, you know, like to learn from, like Carl Barks.
Right.
Because I inked a lot of Duck comics for Western Publishing. Who else influenced me? Robert Crumb.
And you said Frank Zappa, too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
My first boyfriend in college was a big Zappa fan.
Did the artwork on the albums appeal to you at that time, too?
Oh, yeah, Neon Schenkel? Parks. Yeah.
Weasels Rip My Flesh is what you're referring to for Neon, right?
Yeah, that one. Also, Kurtzman was a big influence on me. I read a lot of the EC comics in one sitting, and I was most impressed by his storytelling and his fluidity of line.
Did you ever meet up with him?
Yeah, really nice.
What was that
man.
Like?
I met him toward the end of his life, and I wish I'd been smarter at the time so I could have talked to him on a higher level. I was just kind of a gushy little fangirl at the time. So yeah, the San Diego Comic Con used to be a great place to meet people like, you know, Jack Kirby or Kliban or Kliban, however you say his name. And a lot of, like one year they brought over everybody that was doing work for the National Lampoon. So I'd see Sherry Flanagan or, you know, Dan O'Neill would come down from San Francisco and the Zap guys would be there, and then we'd all go off to a mermaid bar and get plastered. And it used to be a really good time.
Now, it used to be. How has it changed, do you think?
It's all the television shows and films that have anything to do with the supernatural or comics end up promoting their stuff there. And so the people that come now are seem to be more interested in the TV show Serenity than they are in, you know, a comic book that might offer, you know, the same type of imaginative material, but it's just more accessible to people to watch television than it is to read comics. And comics seems to be being shoved aside at the San Diego Con. I think there were 150,000 people there this year. And you get lost in the crowd.
So
it's hard to find people I know anymore.
So that's what you meant about dodging. You don't have to dodge the media here when you're in Portland. It's a completely different kind of thing.
Oh, I'm sure it'll get big and unwieldy in 20 years or something. But, you know,
yeah,
for
we'll
now,
see.
It's just great. There's a lot of cartoonists moving here. And,
yeah. Part of it's Dark
Horse.
Except
for the rain. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be tempted.
Thank you. This is Words and Pictures, and I'm Bill Dodge, and today we're talking with Carol Lay. Do you want to read something?
All right. I'll start with the most recent. When I flew up, what was it, yesterday? The day before yesterday, I was seated next to an aerospace engineer, mm-hmm. and toward the end of the flight, somebody died, and It was very disturbing.
I bet.
But, boy, never die on a plane where there's a cartoonist, because you're going to end up in a comic strip. I'm not sure of the title on this one yet. It might just be Star. And this is still a rough script, but I'll give it a shot. First, there was the Big Bang. Or maybe there was something before that. Who knows? All that energy was needed to transform hydrogen into the heavier elements. So essentially, we are one with the stars. I was reminded of this during a conversation with an aerospace engineer. We were on our way from Los Angeles to Portland, Oregon. Toward the end of a flight, a man stopped breathing. He was seated a couple of rows behind us. A doctor worked hard to revive him, but was apparently unsuccessful. Would his ghost haunt that particular piece of airspace? Would an extra passenger appear for a second in trespassing planes? At the very least, he left the Earth closer to the stars from which he came.
Mm.
I like that somebody had suggested to me the ghost idea,
yeah.
and that I was reminded of the stars by the aerospace engineer, and was able to kind of pay tribute to this poor man who didn't get to go where he was heading. But, you know, we're all headed to the same place eventually. So I've got to go home and draw that one up.
How long does it usually take from the time you're writing in your notebook to a completed strip? Does it just depend on the story?
Yeah. Some are more complicated than others. And I used to spend at least 12 hours on the art, and mm-hmm. I had 12 separate panels, and I did this painstaking lettering process with white tempera on a black field, and before I finally got a typeface made so I could do it on the computer. But as papers have cut out comic sections or just folded,
mm-hmm.
There's far less and there's more competition for the same comic space. So I've lost a number of papers. It's not my main bread and butter anymore. It's just something I do for the love of it and to keep me honest each week. But in the process, and also seeing how small these are printed in some of the papers, I've simplified my style. I've cut down from 12 panels to 6 or more, sometimes even less than that, but basically it's about 6. And I do all the lettering by hand, black on white, which gives it more character, and it's a little larger and more legible.
Mm.
So now I don't take a full day to do a strip anymore. It's less than that.
Mm.
So even though I have no plans to do a collection at this time, I'm saving them up. Kitchen Sink did Now Ennsville, which has 3 longer serialized stories, which is how I started the strip.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see, Now Ennsville, Sweet Sue, and Invisible City, and a few odds and ends. The second book was Joyride, which has a 60-page story I did just for that book. And the balance of the book is story minute strips. And then the last one is just strictly story minute strips called Strip Joint. And I've been talking to people today and just advising them to look remaindered books or used books, because they're still floating around.
They're pretty easy to find in a search for most folks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But my latest book is Goodnight Irene that Last Gasp just put out.
Ah.
It's collected Irene stories from my Good Girls comics that I I started in the early 90s, and basically these stories span 25 years. I do it when I have the time, the luxury of time, because it's always been a labor of love, never money, this character. She's a white heiress who was raised in the jungle a la Tarzan, but because the Bongodians who adopted her had lip discs in their women, it was a mark of beauty. She grew up with that aesthetic, so from an early age she wanted to have a great big lip disc and a nose plug and scarification, and by the time she's a young adult, she's totally tricked out in Bongodian, and then she's discovered by explorers who realize she's the heiress to the wine and dine fortune, and they take her back to Southern California. And it's a parody of romance comics, because she's the richest woman in the world, but she has a face that only a Bongodian mother can love. So men want her for their money, but they're repulsed by her face, and finally she accidentally meets a blind man and has her romance with him and won't let him feel her face. And it just goes on from there. It's so goofy. I just love going to her world.
Oh yeah, it sounds
and,
great.
Satirizing, you know, our culture's obsession with surface beauty, and contrasting a primitive ideal of beauty with our own, which is just becoming more artificial. You know, we're almost meeting, you know, with the all the breast surgery or lip augmentation that people do. It's
or piercing or
we're doing the same thing, just, you know, slightly different results. So that that book has 23 pages of new material and just came out from Last Gasp, and called Goodnight Irene.
You can find information about that at lastgasp.com.
That's right.
And you can find information about that on your website, which is waylay.com.
This one's fairly recent, On the Pont Milvio. Following a trend, the young Romans wrote their names on a lock, attached it to a key on the ancient bridge, and tossed the key into the river. This symbolized their eternal love and faithfulness. As countless more keys resting on the riverbed signified that for others. But the young woman came to regret her vow. She's got a black eye. As she walked to work each day, the lock reminded her of the rash promise. And now she's scuba diving, trying to find her key. Superstitious, she believed she would never truly love again as long as that lock held fast to the bridge, which is how she came to search for the key among the thousands in the cold water. When she finally found the key, it was too rusty to fit in the lock. But one day she saw the city had cut down many of the locks, hers included. Had she been released to love again? Her next lover asked her to pledge her love with a lock on the bridge. She stopped seeing him soon after that.
How does being female color your work?
Sometimes it helps, because as a woman, I'm a novelty item. And they might have a, let's say I'm doing some magazine work, illustration, and they have what they consider a female topic, I might get a call. On the other hand, I get pigeonholed as a female, and I don't get to do the more fun stuff like trucks exploding, which, you know, I would like to do as much as the next guy. Like I had one art director at a magazine. He was sending out the men on really interesting assignments, you know, like, I don't want to get too specific because I don't want to clue anybody who this was. But they got to do really fun stuff.
And you felt
left
out.
The ideas they came up for me were ridiculous, actually, and kind of insulting to women in a way, because he just had very old-fashioned ideas about women in the world.
Mm.
So it's, but in the long run, I'm competing against men. You know, they kind of try to corral us into a female ghetto sometimes. Like there's collections of comics done by women, and I resist joining in on that. But I did participate in Twisted Sisters because it's just a great group of women, and yeah. I like all the people in it. But you know, and I do see the point in banding together to get more visibility for women cartoonists. But in the long run, it's each man for himself in this business,
yeah.
And you just have to be good, get your stuff in on time, and stand out somehow. And I do think that women have to work harder than a man to do the same work. And there is some lingering sexism with certain people, and I just, you know, accept it because it'll change with time, and there's not much I can do about it except do good work.
This does remind me of Patti Smith when Rolling Stone asked her to participate in a Women in Rock issue. She refused because she said a lot of her influences were male, like Allen Ginsberg, and it wouldn't be fair. So she
wasn't
exactly. So why do you think there's such a scarcity of women in this in the comics business?
I think people need a certain assertiveness, mm-hmm. and women are taught from a very young age to be more demure and not to compete on that level.
Mm-hmm.
But I had three older sisters, so I was used to competition.
Ah.
And also I think that you need an extremely logical mind.
True.
And even though women have that capacity, it's not encouraged as much as it is in men. You know, men are more likely to go into the math and sciences.
Yeah.
And I think it's just old programming. Another theory I have is that if a woman is smart enough to do comics, she's smart enough to get into something that pays better.
yeah, good point.
But I just fell in love with the medium because it satisfies so many things I like to do. You know, I'm not the best artist, I'm not the best writer, but I'm really good at the hybrid, which is comics. And I love the, you know, the way that I have to whittle my writing down to almost a poetic form, that it has to lead the eye around the page in a way that makes sense and works kind of, you know, I don't know how to say that, but everything kind of collides on a comics page, and then the page itself has to work within the larger whole, and I found that logic and set theory, exercising those muscles when I was in college, has helped me tremendously in doing comics.
Hmm.
It is a really smart medium.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think that people don't see that because it's seen as a medium for children still, even though a lot of adults are finally discovering graphic novels and so on. But then a lot of cartoonists kind of get stuck in things that they liked as children, you know, and they grow up as fans of the medium. And that is, you know, and that's not something that happened with me. I came at it as an adult, but as a young female reading comics now, I think there's a lot more material out there for young girls. So that might encourage more people to jump in now, to be inspired by it and pursue it as a career. But when I was a kid, there just wasn't much that grabbed my attention. I would rather read a book than a comic book because, you know, they were just kind of dumb. I didn't pick up the right ones. I think that if I had found Uncle Scrooge when I was young, that might have done it for me. But instead, I tried Casper the Friendly Ghost, and it just didn't engage me at all. So, yeah, I think that there's going to be an explosion of women entering the field. I was just talking to Michael Richardson from Dark Horse, saying that, you know, 16-year-old girls are now reading these manga comics like,
you know,
eating them up like candy. Mm-hmm. So it's not a genre that I particularly find fascinating, but it's interesting that younger women are reading them and hopefully getting inspired to do comics.
Right on. Right on. I heard a voice come from afar. It said, my friend, wherever you are.
Right on.
You can still find copies of Mythos, a prose novel I wrote for DC Comics and pocketbooks. They're all over. They for probably $1.50. That was fun. It was. I am not a big superhero fan, but
thank goodness.
Thanks. But at one point, because I live in Los Angeles, I wrote a screenplay, and it got some nice attention. Didn't go anywhere. But I sent it to Charlie Kochman over at DC Comics just for him to, you know, give me some feedback or something, and he really liked it. And he said, well, we're doing this series of books on the Justice League, one novel per the top five characters. And I think that the Wonder Woman writer is going to bow out. Would you be interested in doing that? Mm. And I said, absolutely. Now, I've never written a book before, but I just figure it wasn't that much different from doing comics. You're just describing everything in words that I would be drawing. And
so other than the cover, there's no illustrations for this particular book, right?
That's right. Mm. Alex Ross did covers for all five books. It was a great learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie edited the book and did a great job, and so I was able to be paid to learn how to write a book. And it's pulp fiction, and it was a lot of fun. Even though I've never read a lot of Batman or Superman, Flash or Green Lantern, I just studied up on those characters, fit them in with Wonder Woman, and tried to do something exciting. And I think that one of my favorite lines, Wonder Woman is in this sort of prehistoric ocean, and I'm a scuba diver, so I like staring at fish. And I know that our seas have been vastly depleted of fish since the time that this would have taken place. So I have her swimming around, and the line is, she was swimming in an ichthyologist's wet dream. And that got past the editor, so I was pleased with that.
It's that jive, Jack. Put it in your pocket till I get back. Going to the corner to dig the man. And I don't have time to shake your hand.
To see images that go along with these stories, go to
waylay.com.
Thanks, and www.kboo.fm. You can also hear a more extended version of this interview on our site, kboo.fm. You've been listening to Words and Pictures, and our guest today has been Carol Lay. Thanks very much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in September of 2007, and featuring comics storyteller Carol Lay. I'm S.W. Conser, joined by Bill Dodge. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture. Before we go, I'd like to remind you that your community radio needs your support more than ever. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.